From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, James Adams, the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London, tells us why he thinks war with Iraq will be very brief and very fierce. Also today, what happens after the shooting stops? Dan Pipes of the Foreign Policy Research Institute talks with us about how our alliances in the Gulf might change after war. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg tells us the origins of the word jingoism. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. military in central Saudi Arabia has announced that war with Iraq has begun. The White House had no immediate comment on whether hostilities had really begun. Once news of a possible attack broke on American television, spokesman Marlon Fitzwater rushed from his office into the back rooms of the White House, where President Bush's Oval Office is located. Asked by reporters what was going on, he replied, "I'll tell you as soon as I can." The president was still in his office and had not retired for the evening. ABC television correspondent Gary Shepard reported just minutes ago that there appears to be some sort of attack in progress. Shepard described what appeared to be anti-aircraft fire on the edge of Baghdad. Cable news network's John Holloman also reported seeing flashes in the sky over Baghdad that appeared to be tracers. Explosions and machine gun fire could be heard in the background. At the same time, Radio Pool reporter John Bascom reported from Saudi Arabia that a squadron of F-15 fighter bombers has taken off from a base in central Saudi Arabia. The fighters are designed for long-range bombing at night.
The event that everybody here in Saudi Arabia has been waiting for 5 months has finally happened. At 12:50 in the morning, a squadron of F-15E fighter bombers took off from this massive air base in central Saudi Arabia and headed north. These planes, which are designed to fly long distances and bomb targets on the ground, were completely loaded with bombs and missiles and 20-millimeter guns.
That's John Bascom, the Radio Pool reporter in Saudi Arabia. The base he's reporting from is said to be the largest in the country, with large concentrations of heavily armed attack bombers and other warplanes. Additional reports from Baghdad say that the sky is filled with a hail of bullets as anti-aircraft batteries apparently fired at an unseen attack force. Correspondents reported that the hotel building where they've been staying was shaking from the effects of explosions. Most recently, the correspondents said firing may have eased off a bit. The fighting broke out following months of tension and the failure of negotiations aimed at reversing Iraqi President Saddam Hussein's August 2nd invasion of Kuwait and the annexation of the country. By the time fighting started, more than 1 million soldiers on both sides had poured into the desert confrontation, one of the largest clashes of arms since World War II. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein rejected repeated demands by an international coalition, led by the United States, to withdraw Iraqi forces from the small, oil-rich nation wedged between Iraq and Saudi Arabia at the northern tip of the Persian Gulf. A series of UN resolutions was capped by Security Council action, setting a July 15th deadline for Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait or face war. This is NPR. The Palestine Liberation Organization said today that the killer of three PLO leaders in Tunis had connections to Israel. A top political advisor to the PLO said that although the killer was a former member of the Abu Nidal organization, he was also associated with Israel. He said the assassin, a Palestinian named Hamza Abu Zayed, was being interrogated by a joint body made up of the PLO and Tunisian police. As the confrontation continued today between the governments of the Baltic republics and the Central Soviet authorities in Moscow, funerals were held in the Lithuanian capital, Vilnius, for some of the people who died when Soviet soldiers stormed the city's television tower. From Vilnius, the BBC's Kevin Connolly reports. We'll have that report coming up in a moment, along with more updates on the situation in the Persian Gulf, where it appears that firing has begun. The Military Central Command in Saudi Arabia said that war with Iraq has begun. We've had reports from correspondents in Baghdad that they've seen what appears to be anti-aircraft fire on the edge of the city. Cable News Network's John Holloman reported seeing flashes in the sky over Baghdad that appeared to be tracer fire. They also reported hearing explosions and machine gun fire. At one point, they said that the firing was so heavy that it was shaking the hotel where they were staying. At the same time, there was a radio pool report from reporter John Bascom, who's at that major airbase at an undisclosed location in central Saudi Arabia. He reported that a squadron of F-15 fighter bombers has taken off from a base in central Saudi Arabia. Those fighters are designed for long-range bombing at night, and they're equipped, among other things, with heavy artillery, 20-millimeter guns. That base in the center of Saudi Arabia was built up over the past month. And now,
this is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is a day that Americans are walking around in a daze, asking each other, when do you think the war will start? It's all most of us can talk about, even if we're not sure what is left to say. There are many different projections of what war in the Gulf would be like. Yesterday, Jean LaRocque, the founder of the Center for Defense Information, told us on Fresh Air that the war would be a lot longer and a lot bloodier than the optimistic projections of our government. Today, we invite James Adams to talk with us about what war in the Gulf might be like. Adams is the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London, and he's the author of several books on terrorism, covert warfare, and the new international arms merchants. I spoke with him earlier today from the NPR Bureau in London. He told me a war in the Gulf would be different from any other war.
I think we're going to see the use of massive firepower on a scale that is almost beyond the imagination. The gathering of systems out there is just on a most enormous scale, and the Iraqis certainly have no concept of what is going to be unleashed, and I don't believe many of the Allied commanders do either, but it is going to be awesome.
Can you tell us what you mean by that more specifically?
Well, you've got a gathering of equipment, both aircraft and artillery, each of which, in its own right, is designed to produce the maximum destruction in the most accurate way possible and in the shortest time possible. And each of those pieces of equipment is very good at what it does. When you combine them all together, you really do produce a very devastating conventional system. If you like, you're going to get all the effects of nuclear war without radioactivity. And you will, in the air, for example, see aircraft flying perhaps 6,000 sorties a day, where each aircraft carries an enormous amount of accurate, very accurate, destructive weapons. And all of those will be very specifically targeted.
What do you think the targets would be?
Well, our aim in the first few minutes of the war will be to render the Iraqis deaf and blind. In other words, we will want to degrade their communication systems to such an extent that no soldier will be able to talk to another soldier except by shouting in his ear. And we'll make them blind by rendering their radars ineffective. And if we achieve those two things, which I believe we will do relatively quickly, you're then in a position where, for however long this conflict lasts, the soldier on the ground, and indeed his commanders, will not have any idea about what is going on around him, and so will only see destruction, fire, and death. And those three things will have a either a lethal or a very demoralizing effect on all those forces.
What about civilians? What kind of civilian casualties do you think there would be in this initial air attack?
Well, civilians are an unfortunate casualty of war, whatever you do. And there will be no carpet bombing of Baghdad, let's say. There will be no attacks on civilians' centers. However, there will be attacks on command centers that are built in cities. There will be attacks on airfields that are around cities. And civilians will be killed. But that will be a byproduct and not a direct consequence, if you like. I mean, they're not direct targets. So, yes, there will be civilian casualties. No, they will not be on a scale that some people might have feared if the war had been fought in another way.
So in this scenario, after the air attack, what happens next?
After the air attack, which will go on for some days, the Allies will control the air in its entirety. And the only risk then to Allied air power will be from shoulder-fired ground-to-air missiles, which should not prove to be very effective. So when you have control of the air, you can then decide where and when you strike on the ground. And the idea will be to you will certainly want to launch somewhere a deception operation on a very large scale designed to draw in the Iraqi reserves into ground of your control. Once that begins to happen, you then move your main armored thrust to strike behind and to the flank of the reserves. At the same time, you will probably use your amphibious forces to land at some point on the eastern coast, probably north of Kuwait City. Those two thrusts from the west and the east will then link up and turn south to envelop the reserves from the rear and then sweep up the other forces. That's if it all works perfectly, which it won't.
What are your predictions of how the war might play out on your most optimistic and your most pessimistic days?
On the most optimistic scenario, the gap between perception by the Iraqi commanders and the reality of this war is so enormous that the consequence of the first day or two of Allied bombardment will be total demoralization, and the Iraqi forces, provided we have managed to decapitate the leadership and destroy the commanders, the demoralization will be such that they will surrender in very large numbers indeed, and resistance will crumble in days. In the worst scenario, we won't manage to do that. The Iraqis will have a nuclear weapon and will use it. We will lose very large numbers of people, and their morale will prove to be much stronger than we expect, and war will last weeks, perhaps months. And if that happens, then God knows what the future holds. I actually believe that is extremely unlikely, the latter scenario, but war is all about uncertainty, and this is an uncertain environment.
You mentioned Iraq could use a nuclear weapon, but they haven't built a nuclear weapon yet.
Well, war is all about what we believe to be the case and then find that our belief is ill-founded. There is no doubt at all that we will have some surprises for the Iraqis, and I would expect that they will have one or two surprises for us. If I were Saddam Hussein, I would have accelerated all my weapon manufacturing programs in the last 5 months and would have something in my locker that is going to give us a nasty fright. The nastiest thing he can do to us is detonate a nuclear device. I don't know whether he's capable of doing that, but I'm pretty damn sure he's going to try. And we don't know, we genuinely don't know, whether he's capable of doing that or not. Hopefully he isn't. Hopefully what he's got is anthrax and one or two other biological weapons and chemical weapons, and if we do our job properly, he won't manage to use those.
James Adams is my guest, the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. What do you expect will happen to Israel? Do you think Saddam Hussein will fire on Israel?
There are two questions in there. One is, will Saddam Hussein launch a preemptive strike? Militarily, he should. Politically, it seems less likely that he will, because he won't want to lose the moral high ground of the one being attacked. He will therefore be able to portray himself as victim. Now, if he is going to hit Israel, how is he going to achieve this? His bombers, of which he's got about 20 that could do the job, I don't think would get through the air defenses. He has Scud B missiles. Now, we have identified the location of most of those and will take them out in the first few minutes of war. So he then has the remainder. Now, we know that the Scud missile commander on the ground gets his orders from Baghdad, from somebody not a million miles away from Saddam Hussein. So that message has got to be transmitted somehow. Well, there won't be any communications, so that's one point. Second, you've got the missiles have got, they don't just press a button and they fire. You've got several hours where you've got to prepare them, fuel them up, warm them up, fire them up, that kind of thing. We will probably detect some of those doing that. We'll take them out before they go. Then you've got some that actually get off. Now, he's only got 30 launches to start with, so perhaps he's left with two or three. Now, Israel has got some defensive screens. Hopefully they'll be fully working by the time those missiles come over. Even if they get through those defensive screens, they've got to hit the target, and they're very unreliable Scud missiles. So you're not looking at very much, and you're looking at a possibility that none will get through at all. And once one is launched, we'll to see it, of course, taking off, and that launcher is destroyed, so there won't be any second barrage. You'll only get one go at it. So I'm not sure how great the threat to Israel is. Logically, when you work it through like that, the threat is not actually that high. But of course, war is about things going wrong. And undoubtedly, things will go wrong, and maybe the threat is higher than that. But I don't believe Israel will be devastated, as some people have been saying. There may be one or two missiles might get through, but that's it.
I've read that one of the Pentagon's worst fears is that in spite of this incredible airstrike that we would launch at the beginning of the war, that the war would end up in trench warfare. This is not what they predict is going to happen, but their worst fear of what could happen. Why would that be so terrible for the American military?
Well, you don't want to get involved in a hand-to-hand fight with hundreds of thousands of Iraqi forces where it is bayonet against bayonet, and you've got highly trained troops stabbing each other. That is a very costly, slow method of prosecuting what should be a very fast, high-tech war. So no one wants that to happen. One of the reasons why we will use air power and artillery to such an extent is that we want to ensure that that doesn't happen. And what I think is perhaps not appreciated is the utter devastation that this kind of barrage can affect on the troops who are on the receiving end. After 2 days of artillery barrage at the front, and this is from ground artillery, not from the air, there will be no soldier who has been exposed to it, who is capable of fighting, who has the will. They will be suffering from total demoralization. They will be suffering from St. Vitus's dance. They will be unable to hold their weapons. Their psychology, their physical makeup would be literally like a jelly. They will be unable to fight. It is a most devastating method of prosecuting war. And the Iraqis have no concept, no training, no understanding at all of what is going to occur. And that is the biggest and most appalling thing about all of this, that Saddam Hussein has misled his people to such an extent that the gap between the perception and the reality is so vast.
We've heard a lot of reports about how strong the Iraqi ground forces are and how many of them are willing to die for the cause. What's your reading on the strength of the Iraqi ground forces and how that would affect us in war?
I think some of them are quite good in a, particularly the Revolutionary Guards, in a very limited sense. Their experience is fighting a static war against an opposition, namely the Iranians, that are fairly well matched with them. Now, they have designed to fight a war that is just a static. They've built 400 kilometers of obstacle courses and fixed positions, which in the sort of context of the mobile war that the Allies will be fighting is complete lunacy. So they misunderstand the nature of the war. And if they misunderstand it in this rather basic way, I don't believe that the forces who are expecting to fight one kind of war and are going to fight something completely different beyond their comprehension and experience, I don't believe that they're going to be able to fight very effectively. And I also don't believe that even their best trained troops have any understanding of what is going to happen. None of them have, for example, suffered air attacks in the sort of way that the Allies can prosecute them. And air attack, when you can do nothing about it, is a really terrifying experience. And I just don't believe that their morale will sustain against that kind of onslaught. So, yes, they're competent, mixed competency spread around depending on where you go and which unit you're talking about. But even the most competent is not half a match for what they're going to face.
James Adams is my guest. He's the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London and the author of several books on covert warfare and the new arms merchants. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. James Adams is my guest, the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. You're confident that no matter how the war begins and no matter how it plays out, that Iraq will surrender.
That depends slightly on whether we surrender implies you have a central organization that says, I give up. Now, it may be that after a week, Saddam Hussein is dead. Most of his commanders are dead. We have no method because we have destroyed most of their underground bunkers, their communication centers. We actually have no method of taking the surrender, even if we could find anybody who had the authority to surrender. So you may not have a situation where Iraq surrenders. You may instead have a situation where forces on the ground give up, where we have 300,000 prisoners of war, 100,000 dead, and another 100,000 injured, and people have just stopped fighting. Now, that is as likely a scenario as Saddam Hussein saying, I give up. I don't actually think we'll see Saddam Hussein saying, I give up. I think his officers would shoot him before that happens. So it's how the surrender would occur, how victory would be achieved, is very difficult to know. It will be a very chaotic environment. There will be nobody walking out from some fort somewhere, a la John Wayne, with a white flag in hand saying, stop, I've had enough. It's not going to be like that at all.
So you think that there might be some question about how the United States would know that Iraq is ready to surrender?
Well, that's a very legitimate question because it's something that's been debated in the Pentagon of how, if you kill Saddam Hussein, the symbol of resistance, how then do you take victory? How do you know when you're victorious? When is the war over? That is a very legitimate issue. It's just the same when we used to worry about the Soviet Union. Do you kill the Politburo? If you kill the Politburo, how does the Soviet Union ever give up? Well, it's a very difficult question to answer. And there is an argument, therefore, to say you actually leave Saddam Hussein in power, fighting to the last, because at least you can ring him up and say, OK, Saddam, have you had enough? And if he says yes, you can sort of legitimately say, OK, it's all over now. But that is how that question has been resolved, I don't know.
What kind of security measures are being taken in England now against terrorism?
There is greater security measures being imposed now than at any other time that I can recall. I think any other time ever, we would be safe to say. And the same thing applies in the US. The response to the terrorist threat is based not on intelligence that says so-and-so has been seen moving from such-and-such and has picked up weapons or is planning to target this. There has been no hard intelligence, really, of any kind. Instead, what all the Western intelligence agencies are doing is basing their response to the perceived threat, the recognition that Saddam Hussein controls a number of terrorist organizations, Abu Nidal, for example, Abu Abbas, for another example, and they are a potent force which there is no doubt Saddam Hussein will attempt to use. Now, we are trying to respond to that, upping the security at airports, for example, because aircraft are a clear target. The guard on vulnerable individuals is being heightened. Businesses are taking precautions. There is a major effort worldwide, and that's going to make life for the terrorists quite difficult. I'm quite confident they will manage to carry out some acts, but I'm equally confident that they're not going to find it nearly as easy as some of the media would have us believe, or indeed as some of the terrorists themselves might believe, because what the terrorist likes least in the world is to attack a target that knows it's going to be attacked. So it's going to be difficult for them, but I'm sure they will manage to have some success.
If and when this war starts, where will you be reporting from?
Well, I'm heading in your direction. I'll be coming to Washington. In fact, I'll be there for the duration of the crisis.
Why are you coming to Washington?
Well, I go where there is information, and I believe that I will be able to get more information in Washington than I will in London or Riyadh or anywhere else for that matter. I think this is going to be a very fast war, and I need to do my job to get access to accurate and timely information, and I think that'll be available in Washington.
Do you have a different level of emotional involvement in covering what's happening in the Gulf than you've had in covering any other conflict?
That's a very difficult question. My experience of covering conflicts has basically been at the low intensity level, where to some extent one feels much more vulnerable. It's a thing I live with all the time in dealing with the IRA. I live with that threat constantly, and dealing with low intensity conflict tends to be a very personal thing, because you tend to be down on the ground, and you can just as easily tread on the mine or be a victim of a shooting or a bombing as the next guy, whether he's in a uniform or not. This kind of conflict is a different level altogether. What I find very difficult to deal with it is I understand, or at least I think I understand, the consequences of what is about to be undertaken. I believe the war is a just war, but the devastation is going to be appalling, and it has occurred because Saddam Hussein is too damn stupid to understand what's happening. And when there is a gap of knowledge matched by arrogance and stupidity, I guess this sort of things is what always causes war, but in this instance, that this silly man can really believe that he can achieve anything. And I genuinely believe that he still thinks he can bring something out of this carnage that is going to result, that I am filled with infinite sadness, really, that it should come to this. But there you go.
James Adams, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
James Adams is the defense correspondent of the Sunday Times of London. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. America is bracing for war, but what does our government hope to achieve? Coming up, we consider how American relations in the Middle East might change after the shooting stops. We talk with Dan Pipes, director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Also, jingoism. Linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us the history of the word. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A short while ago, the White House announced that what it called the liberation of Kuwait has started. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater.
The United States has moved under the code name Operation Desert Storm to enforce the mandates of the United Nations Security Council. As of 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Operation Desert Storm forces were engaging targets in Kuwait and Iraq.
Reports first came this evening from ABC and CNN, who have correspondents in Baghdad. They reported seeing lights and sirens and what appeared to be anti-aircraft fire. CNN reported that the night skies filled with a hail of bullets from anti-aircraft guns and what appeared to be explosions off in the distance. Then the noise appeared to die down and the sky became clear. What about the implications for the other Persian Gulf nations in the area? NPR's Jackie Lydon is in Jordan.
For Jordan, what Jordan will be looking for is some desperate way to stay out, but the worst-case scenario is that Iraq strikes Tel Aviv and Tel Aviv retaliates through Jordan, that Israel retaliates through Jordan, either by sending missiles across Jordan or, more likely, by sending pilots across Air Force Base here. That means that Jordan will feel compelled to try to shoot those Israeli planes down. The Air Forces are very unevenly matched, so Jordan will be defeated after a bit. Israel will also try to shoot down Hawk anti-aircraft guns that Jordan has lined up across the border. So that is the worst-case scenario for Jordan. We don't know at all, of course, if something like that is underway just yet.
NPR's Jackie Lydon reporting from Amman, Jordan. The fighting broke out following months of tension and the failure of negotiations aimed at reversing Iraqi President Saddam Hussein's August 2nd invasion of Kuwait and the annexation of that country. By the time fighting had started, more than 1 million soldiers on both sides had been poured into the desert confrontation, one of the largest clashes of arms since World War II. Saddam rejected repeated demands by an international coalition led by the United States to withdraw Iraqi forces from the small, oil-rich nation wedged between Iraq and Saudi Arabia at the northern tip of the Persian Gulf. A series of UN resolutions was capped by Security Council actions, setting a January 15th deadline for Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait or face fighting. Earlier today, Pope John Paul II called for a last-minute effort at dialogue in an effort to prevent war in the Persian Gulf. The Pope, in personal messages to both President Bush and Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, called on Iraq to make a grand gesture for peace. In New York City today on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 18 points to close at 2,508.91 on volume of some 135 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of about 2 to 1. This is NPR News. The White House announced today that U.S.-led forces in the Persian Gulf attacked targets in Kuwait and Iraq, and the liberation of Kuwait had begun. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater told reporters the president would make a statement to the American people at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The U.S. military made the announcement that war with Iraq had begun from central Saudi Arabia, where a squadron of U.S. fighter bombers took off. NPR's Pentagon correspondent Vicki O'Hara reports.
Here's what we know thus far. According to a radio pool reporter, John Bascom, in Saudi Arabia, a squadron of F-15s took off from an airbase in central Saudi Arabia at 12:50 a.m. Saudi time. The pool report says the squadron headed north, fully loaded with bombs, missiles, and 20-millimeter guns. CNN and ABC television have been broadcasting the sounds of explosions live from Baghdad. Their correspondents in the Iraqi capital report that bombing of strategic targets has begun. Those reporters also say that they can see lights in the sky in formation, and they say that anti-aircraft fire has been coming from the ground. In Washington, this is Vicki O'Hara.
Earlier today, in Iraq, state radio had been giving instructions on how to cope with air raids if war should break out. Many stores today in the capital were closed as more residents left the city. Officials have ordered street lights turned off at night, shortly before the UN deadline passed for Iraq to get out of Kuwait or face the possibility of military action. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein told his troops that Iraq is ready to take on the multinational force arrayed against it. World financial markets traded feverishly as the U.S. went to war with Iraq. Oil prices trading in the after-hours market immediately shot up as sounds of gunfire and airplanes were broadcast on television from Baghdad. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We've heard a lot about what might happen during a war in the Middle East. My guest, Daniel Pipes, has some ideas on what might happen after a war. Pipes is the director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He's written many books on the Middle East, including The Long Shadow, Culture and Politics in the Middle East, In the Path of God, Islam and Political Power, and Greater Syria, The History of an Ambition. Pipes has also served in the State Department. Daniel Pipes isn't sure if America has thought through what it would hope to achieve by a military victory in the Middle East.
I think it's a traditional failing of American war making, is that the actual military confrontation is the easy part, and it's turning the success on the battlefield into political victory that's tough. That's certainly the case. The most spectacular example is Vietnam. I mean, the United States won that war on the battlefield, but lost it politically. I don't know if such planning is going on or not. I'm glad I don't know, in a way, because I'm not, we shouldn't know this. But I fear a bit. And so, therefore, I've been doing some thinking and some writing about it, offering some thoughts about the optimal arrangement after the shooting stops. What is it that we seek, and how do we get to it? What we seek, I think, is two things. One, an Iraq that is stable, defensible, and non-belligerent. That is to say, Iraq should remain what it is today. It should not be cut up. It should not have the capacity to invade other states, nor should it be invaded by others, to be too weak and therefore invaded. Second, on a larger scale, I think we're interested in a balance in the Persian Gulf. There are three significant powers there: Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. And it's in our interest that none of those three predominate. If one of them does, then it could mean very, very bad consequences in terms of oil. That one state would try and control it and let it go, not let it go, the oil, depending on its own interests. When there's a balance, there's much less possibility of that threat. So we're interested in Iraq that is stable, that fits into a regional balance. And the hard part is, how do we get there?
What do you think some of the mistakes are that could be made and should be avoided?
One, perhaps the most contentious question is, what about Saddam Hussein himself? Many people feel that he should be a target of our war.
Kill him.
And while I have no problem with eliminating Saddam Hussein, I would be very reluctant to have that be a war aim. I think if we did, that would raise the stakes. Let me give a parallel. In World War II, the Allies said that they demanded unconditional surrender. Emotionally satisfying to learn that Hitler committed suicide in his bunker. But it probably extended the war by over a year. Had the Allied forces been willing to deal with the Germans, the war would have come to an end much sooner. Many lives would not have been lost. Emotionally not as satisfying, but I think probably a better order would have turned out in Europe as a result. And so I'm inclined to announce in advance that Saddam Hussein is not our target. We'd be delighted if his bodyguards shoot him or if there's a military rebellion or something else, but he is not our prey. We will deal with him if need be.
So you would be hoping that there would be some channel of communication that would remain open during a war between the United States and Iraq, to always be testing the waters to see if he was ready to surrender?
Essentially, yes. I have two imperatives. The first is that we destroy the unconventional capabilities in Iraq, that is to say, the chemical, biological, nuclear, as well as some of the long-range missiles and other programs. That's on the floor. We have to do at least that. In other words, throwing the Iraqis out of Kuwait is not enough. We also have to get rid of some of the capabilities. At the ceiling, I think we must not occupy Iraq. It would be a disaster for American troops to move into Iraq and take control of the country. The range we have to maneuver in is somewhere between destroying the unconventional capabilities and occupying the country. If that means lines of communication with Saddam, I've got no problem with that.
Do you think that our alliances will hold up after the shooting stops? Our alliances in the Middle East.
The current alliance is a pretty fragile one, with Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Syria in particular. I'm skeptical that the one with Syria will last too long. It is very tactical. Let's say short range. There are some interests we have in common, but there are many more we don't. With Egypt and Saudi Arabia, I'm more inclined to see it lasting, in part because they've existed now for some time.
My guest is Daniel Pipes, director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Dan Pipes is my guest, director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. It wasn't too long ago that Iraq was considered more of a friend and Syria more of a foe. How would you compare Hafez al-Assad of Syria to Saddam Hussein of Iraq?
Yeah, that's a nice comparison. Saddam Hussein moved into Kuwait early on August 2nd. It took him 4 hours to take Kuwait. October 13th, Hafez al-Assad moved into Beirut. It took him 3 hours. The contrast not so much in 4 hours and 3 hours, but the fact that Saddam Hussein is now facing the forces of the world, almost, and Hafez al-Assad is facing no opposition whatsoever. And that's symbolic of the difference between them. They're similar in many ways, their aspirations, their brutality, but Hafez al-Assad is far more cunning. He's the most brilliant politician of the Middle East. He has weak resources. His base is a small one. He doesn't have oil to speak of. He doesn't have the advantages that Saddam Hussein has, but he's much craftier. He uses terrorism as an instrument of state. I mean, unlike, say, Muammar Gaddafi, who just kills. Unlike Saddam Hussein, who blunders in. I mean, it was an idiotic thing to do what he did on August 2nd, from many points of view. Hafez al-Assad is crafty. So they're similar at base, but they differ in that one is a great politician and the other is a much, much inferior politician.
Do you think Hafez al-Assad doesn't strike the dictator pose and make those, you know, those kinds of crazy statements that Saddam Hussein will make, you know, that immediately alienate people and show him to be an almost cartoon-like dictator?
Absolutely different in that sense. His speeches are far more nuanced. His policies are nuanced. His relations with the outside world are nuanced. No, he doesn't. He will never become an enemy. I mean, when we had the worst relations with him, we still had high-level people, such as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Vernon Walters, traveling to Damascus to talk to Hafez al-Assad about the hostages that he was keeping. But he was doing it at two removed, so he could present himself in the guise of their liberator rather than their jailer. Brilliant. There's no comparison between the two on the level of politics. But ultimately, they're very similar. I have no problem working with Hafez al-Assad now, just as I had no problem working with Saddam Hussein 3 years ago. 3 years ago, the big threat of the Middle East was the Iranian one. Khomeini was alive. He had a vibrant ideology. He was threatening to overrun Iraq and thereby overrun who knows what else, remake the map of the Middle East. And Saddam Hussein, willy-nilly, was protecting our interests, status quo, commercial interests that we have, kind of keeping things more or less as they are. And so it was right to work with him. Khomeini died, or the war came to an end, Khomeini died. The Iranian government is absorbed with domestic issues. Saddam invades a country. He's the aggressor. Well, he's got to be stopped now. It means a flip. There's a certain, looked at minutely, there's an inconsistency. 1 year supporting Saddam, next year against him. But looked at more abstractly, there's a consistency there. We're helping the invaded. Saddam invaded Iran in 1980. We more or less helped the Iranians. The Iranians invaded Iraq in 1982. We helped Iraq. Iraq invades Kuwait. We're helping Kuwait. The Syrians come to help Kuwait. We work with the Syrians. There is a logic behind it all. And to those who criticize it, I would say, what's the alternative? Are we going to work with the invaders?
So you have what you perceive to be a very pragmatic approach to which dictator you support when.
It's essentially helping the losing side. Mm-hmm. It boils down to that.
Well, do you think that President Bush shares that point of view and that lies behind his motivation now?
In one sense, yes. The problem with the U.S. policy, the only thing I really criticize, was that between the end of the war in 1988 and the invasion of Kuwait 2 years later, we kept on supporting Iraq. Even though the war was over, Saddam was not on our side in any sense anymore, and he was increasingly belligerent. We didn't seem to notice that.
Let me ask you this. If you think that the United States has been backing various dictators in the Middle East for reasons similar to the ones you expressed, do you think it's really hypocritical of our leadership to be pointing to Saddam Hussein and talking about how Saddam Hussein has tortured his own people and so on, knowing that people we've supported in Latin America, in the Middle East, in other parts of the world have done exactly the same?
I wouldn't say it's hypocritical, but I would agree that it's not exactly consistent. It's not hypocritical in that when you get to a region like the Middle East, well, there are essentially just two democracies, Israel and Turkey. You can't just work with those two states. You have to work with others. Or in Latin America 10 years ago when there were essentially no democracy, you have to have working relationships. You have to have trade relationships. You have to have military security relations. So you can't have too high a standard. Otherwise, your interests suffer. You have to work with dictators, and some of those dictators will be nasty ones. Two points. One is that in terms of humanitarian concerns and human rights abuses, the United States generally has a moderating effect. I mean, you will find overall that states that are hooked up to us rather than, say, the Soviets generally perform better, come under pressure. You know, just because there are hearings in this country and there are discussions and there is the press to look at it and there's pressure on them. They don't become liberal democracies overnight, but they tend to improve. Second, we form our alliances not on the basis of humanitarian records. We form our alliances for reasons of state, for security and other interests. And that is, I think, it should be. I think, ultimately, that mix of humanitarian and national interest is the proper way to view American relations to the outside world.
Is this coming war a war you support?
Oh, sure. Support in the sense of, had I been in the Senate, would I have voted with the president? I certainly would have. My view has been war now or war later. War now with a small bully or war later with a big bully. Now without nuclear and biological weapons and missiles that can reach Europe or maybe even us. Later, perhaps with all those capabilities. War now is better also because the alliance that's been cobbled together is unique. And at the same time, as we approach it, I'm very apprehensive. There's so many things that can go wrong. And the two biggest, I think, are the collapse of Iraq, of authority in Iraq, and the collapse of the Jordanian government. Either of those could take place, and they have terrible potential consequences. So I'm extremely apprehensive, but I think, you know, a crisis has been created, and there is really no benefit in backing out because there is very great likelihood that it will be even worse a few years later. So better to bite the bullet, deal with it now, than put it off and have it in far more acute form in 1995.
What about the loss of life, the tens of thousands who might be killed in Americans and American allies, and Iraqis as well. And what about the ecological catastrophes that might be the outcome of the war? It seems to so many people that in this day and age, although we have the most high-tech weapons we've had before, that there's something really outdated about actually following through on such a high-tech and horrible war.
No, that goes without saying that it's horrible. I don't quite understand what outdated means.
That surely the diplomacy has to have risen to a new level as well, that surely there must be a way besides massacring people on both sides and paying this terrible cost.
Yeah. There's an assumption behind what you're saying that we're getting smarter and that just as children grow into adults and don't fight each other physically when they disagree, that so governments once reverted to physical means but now no longer need to. I don't think that's true. I think it's true with democracies. It's true that democracies don't go to war against each other, that they have other means of disputing, of educating their disputes. But it's not true among dictators. It'll never be true among dictators. And therefore, I don't think force is outdated. As for the loss of life, well, it goes without saying, that's a terrible consequence. And in particular, on the Iraqi side, it's worth noting that the Iraqi, I mean, we have nothing. I have nothing. You have nothing, I suppose, against Iraqis as such. There's no national hatred for Iraqis. In many ways, they're victims. I don't exaggerate that. There clearly is complicity, and Saddam Hussein didn't come out of nowhere. But the average Iraqi has no more responsibility for this crisis than anyone else. And that they should go through what looks to be a terrible period is a tragedy that adds to the other tragedies they've suffered from. I mean, if we were to talk about human rights in Iraq, it'd make you cry, as well as what's happened in Kuwait. So yes, from that point of view, it's a tragedy all around. But again, I support this because I think the tragedy will go on and get worse unless Saddam Hussein is dealt with now.
Dan Pipes, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Daniel Pipes is the director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute based in Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel is with us. Robert, what do you have now that the deadline is over?
Well, we have reports from our correspondents in and around the Persian Gulf on what's happened today there. We also have a report by environmental reporter John Nielsen here in Washington about what the likely effects would be of Saddam Hussein destroying Kuwait's 743 oil wells, which he has threatened to do, rather than leave them behind. And on the other front of troubles, the major one in the world, we'll be talking about Soviet violence in Latvia and new press restrictions. We'll hear what Soviet editor Vitaly Korotich thinks about them.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The current world crisis has linguist Jeff Nunberg reflecting on etymology and history.
Who first said that history repeats itself? Some people credit Hegel, but Montaigne made the same observation, and so did Plutarch, and so did Thucydides. One thing is sure, it was Marx who added that history repeats itself twice, the first time as tragedy and the second as farce. In this, as in so many things, Marx was an optimist. History doesn't stop at a second run-through. After the farce is played out, it returns as etymology. Take the word jingoism, which denotes a belligerent nationalism. The word encapsulates the whole history of British imperialism. It originated in 1878 in the political crisis over what the British called the Eastern Question. The Bulgarians had rebelled against their Turkish masters. The Turks suppressed the rising with terrible massacres and atrocities. Then the Tsar declared war on the Turkish Sultan in the name of his oppressed Slavic brethren. The English had been watching Russia warily since the Crimean War of the 1850s. That bloody exercise accomplished nothing. But it did enrich the English language. It gave us Tennyson's Charge of the Light Brigade, not to mention the Raglan Sleeve and the Cardigan Sweater, which were named after the commanders who had ordered the brigade to glorious slaughter at the Russian batteries at Balaclava. Along with Wellington boots and the Eisenhower jacket, they remind us of the great debt that haberdashery owes to generals. Back to 1878. As the Tsar's troops advanced on Constantinople, the British prepared to go to war with Russia again. Queen Victoria told Prime Minister Disraeli she felt she couldn't remain the sovereign of a country that was letting itself down to kiss the feet of the great barbarians. Pro-war mobs took to the streets. They broke the windows of the house of opposition leader William Gladstone, who wanted Britain to side with the Christian Bulgarians against the Turks. As their anthem, they took the words of a popular music hall song, "We don't want to fight, but by jingo if we do, we've got the men, we've got the ships, we've got the money too." The pro-war party came to be called the Jingos or Jingoists. Disraeli sent a British fleet to the Dardanelles, but war was averted when the sides signed a treaty at the Congress of Berlin in June of 1878. The Russians got a couple of slices of Turkish territory, and the Turks got Bulgaria back after promising to treat the Christians more kindly. Britain, which hadn't fired a shot, got the island of Cyprus. Disraeli described the outcome with another phrase that would enter the language as peace with honor. But the British public was having second thoughts about selling out the Bulgarians. The affair became an issue in the 1880 elections, when Disraeli was turned out in favor of Gladstone, though that result may have owed as much to a national recession. Gladstone was less bellicose than Disraeli, but that proved in turn to be his political undoing. In 1882, the celebrated General Gordon got himself besieged at Khartoum by the armies of the Islamic holy man known as the Mahdi. The jingoist resurfaced, by now a common noun, demanding that a relief force be sent. But Gladstone hesitated, unwilling to sacrifice British lives for a territory so remote and inhospitable. The relief force reached Khartoum 3 days too late to save General Gordon. Gladstone's government was discredited and turned out of office. Gordon's death was not avenged until 15 years later, when General Kitchener led an expedition that reconquered the Sudan and killed the Mahdi and 10,000 of his men. It was a famous victory, but its only contribution to English literature was Kipling's Fuzzy Wuzzy, which is hardly in a class with the Charge of the Light Brigade. Neither Gordon nor Kitchener left his name on an article of clothing. Linguistically, the Pacific Mr. Gladstone probably came off best of anyone. The Gladstone bag is a suitcase divided into hinged compartments, a nice place to stow your kit when cooler heads prevail.
Linguist Jeff Nunberg. Fresh Air's theme music is composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, historian Avan Haddad examines the resurgence of Islamic fundamentalism and its cultural and political significance. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.